Good afternoon. This is Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle, independent community radio broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Today is Monday at 12 noon, so you must be listening to the Epic Storytelling Hour with your host, Fanny Crawford. You can tune in on any internet device at www.enlightenradio.org. My guest this afternoon is Stuart Acuff, radio personality, raconteur, and kitchen table storyteller from West Tennessee originally, labor organizer in Atlanta, Georgia, Philadelphia, PA, and other places. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning. Thank you, Fanny, for having me on. It's great to be with you today. Great to see you.
It's taken a while, hasn't
it?
We've been trying to do this.
It's taken too long. I've been in and out, up and down.
Well, thanks for being flexible this week and squeezing
always,
us
Fanny,
in.
Always, Fanny. Thank you very much.
It's really good to be sitting across the studio from you.
Right.
Thanks for being here. And some of our listeners may remember you from WSHC, the Shepherdstown University, Shepherd University station at 89.7.
Right.
You were, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were on with John Case and John Christensen.
That's right.
On Labor Beat.
On Labor Beat. At least once a month, but often much more than that.
And most of that was commentary, but you also regaled our listeners with poetry now and then.
I did.
And I'm hoping to get you to tell or do a poem or two while you're on air today with us.
Great. I would love to. I'm an unreconstructed poet.
The best kind.
Blue denim poet.
Very good. And I know you're going to tell some stories while you're with
us
today,
indeed.
Because you can't help it. They right. just spin out of you. So,
yeah, sometimes I tell them when nobody wants to listen to them.
Well, today everybody wants to listen because this is a storytelling show.
Good.
So that's why you're here.
Good. And when you get to be 62, Fanny, don't you have a right to tell some stories about your life?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you're asking the wrong person. Everybody has a right to tell stories. You
right.
won't get any argument there.
Right.
By the time you get to your 60s, you have a right to buttonhole people and make them listen. Because the assumption is you've found some wisdom along the way.
Right. So that's the assumption.
It's time to share. You just need a hook to reel in the younger generation.
Yeah.
Get
yeah.
them to listen. But I've heard your hooks, so I know that people
Good.
Do want to hear your stories.
Good.
So I wanted to start with some stories that I've heard you tell about your original family, your West yeah. Tennessee and Kentucky family. And I'm just fascinated by these little snippets that you've shared, and I'm eager to hear a bit more. So where do you want to start?
Well, thank you, Fanny. My people are all from northwest Tennessee, about 100 miles north of Memphis, not far south of the Kentucky line, what I like to say, hard by the Mississippi River, close enough to the Mississippi River to live in the bottomlands. Now, most Americans refer to bottomlands as swamps. We call them bottomlands,
okay.
But they were swamps, and they would flood every spring. Made for real rich soil and great hickory trees and great cypress trees and great oak trees. And those swamps are still wild today.
Aren't
you
they?
Can't do anything with it except cut the wood.
Mm.
But they flood too much to farm. And so the mud and the rain kind of protected that land from exploitation.
Mm.
And those bottomlands are still wild today. And that's how my grandfather got started as a man. My grandfather, my mother's father, on my mother's side, we were Scots-Irish, American Indian, and African American. And my mother used to say, well, her people were Black Indians. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather, my mother's father, when he was a young man, instead of owning mules, he owned oxen. He owned two oxen. Now, oxen, friends and neighbors, ladies and gentlemen, are full-grown dairy bulls that are castrated when they reach their full size. So they're huge animals. They might be as tall as a man at their withers, or close to as tall as a man at their withers, and massively strong. And we called my grandfather Dandy. Don't ask me why. You know, it's the oldest grandkid gets to pick the name. So
it was one of my cousins. That's a great tradition.
Yeah. Well,
I'm the oldest grandchild. I would have loved that.
that my cousin Charladan picked the name for Dandy. Anyway, he made what in those days would have seemed like a lot of money in Northwest Tennessee by working the swamps with his oxen. And so he would use his oxen to snake the logs out of the bottoms. And that's oak, hickory, and cypress logs out of the bottom. See, oxen have big feet, like as big as my hand, bigger than my hand. And they splay out. You know, oxen hooves are cloven, and they splay out like a cow's hooves splay out. And mules, which was the primary beast of burden in Tennessee, have little dainty donkey hooves. You know, mules are a cross between a horse and a donkey. Sure. And you get a mule in that mud, in that bottom land, and they'll sink all the way up to their belly. And the oxen feet would splay out. So he was able to move a lot more timber and lumber out of those bottoms with those oxen than anybody could with a mule.
How did he figure that out? Did someone teach him that?
Somebody provided the wisdom. I don't think he figured that out on his own. He had a lot of, you know, he had a very diverse background, and a lot of people knew a lot of things. And he was a very self-sufficient man. I didn't know him very long. He passed when I was, I think, 6. But when I was a little boy, he would talk to me about the oxen, and he made me a little leather whip that I could play with like I was driving a couple of oxen. And, you know, you drive oxen with voice commands. You don't put a bridle on them. You put a yoke, and it's that harnesses them to pull the weight. And then you use your voice, and get up means let's go, you know, giddy up. Mm-hmm. Whoa means stop, obviously. G is to go right, and haul is to go left. And he taught me those commands, and we played oxen in the front yard. And my folks still had to go to his cotton fields in the fall to pick cotton. Because he just had this little, what I call yeoman's farm. It was just a farm big enough for a family to take care of. My mother never tired of telling me how hard she had to work on that farm. And I know she did. She chopped cotton all summer and picked cotton all fall. And they made me my own little cotton sack. And when I go to the fields with my folks, because nobody was there to watch out for me, so I go to the fields with my folks. Now, folks, if I was a better storyteller right here, I'd lie and tell you I picked a lot of cotton, but I didn't. I sat at the end of the rows under a big old oak tree and played in the dust had a good time. So that was, you know, that was my grandfather, Dandy. He lived in a little house, heated it with coal stove, a coal cook stove was the stove that he made food in or on. Didn't have any running water. Had a pump handle at the kitchen sink and an outhouse out back. But he did have electricity. Now, so here's where the story hour gets a little political. He had electricity because of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Tennessee Valley Authority, which supplied the power to light up the Southeast and to bring the Southeast into the age of machines. And then that power was distributed by the REA, Rural Electrification Authority. Both of those were publicly owned, and both of those were creatures of the Depression created by Franklin Delano Roosevelt to put people to work and to make the economy more productive, and to allow for more innovation. Mm-hmm. Because innovation's a lot easier when you got electricity. It's harder if you're doing it by yourself. But and so I was raised in Northwest Tennessee, and Southeast Missouri, right across the river, the part of Missouri that dips down into Arkansas, and rural people. My dad was a Baptist preacher. And my mother was a school teacher. At least when she was a school teacher, whenever we were so poor, she had to go to work.
And what did she do with her when she wasn't teaching? Was she working on the farm in the winter?
Well, she did when she grew up. But now when by the time I came along, my folks were independent of my grandfather.
Okay.
And my dad, Fanny, was a really good preacher, but I can say this now because both my mom and dad have gone home. I don't think my dad was a great pastor because we moved a lot. He made a great first impression, that sermon. And then after about 2 or 3 years, it'd be time for us to move to the next little town.
They're very different jobs that the
they
same
really
person
are.
Is required to...
Especially in the Baptist church, mm-hmm. because you're expected to bring fire every Sunday. Well, actually, 3 times a week, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, and Wednesday evening.
So is that partly where your story spinning skills came from?
Well, my mother was the great storyteller. I mean, my dad could tell stories, but my mother just relished in it. She loved holding forth over the kitchen table with whoever might be visiting. And she loved to tell stories. I remember, you know, when I was coming up, you know, the family would sit around. And one of the things that the family would do, if you didn't have radio or TV, is tell stories, family stories, right? And so... you know, I have a poem called All of Us. I don't have it with me today, but it's probably my favorite poem that I wrote. And it's about the women in my family. Well, not just the women. It's about the people in my family talking about the end, the last of the Eastern Panthers. A panther is a mountain lion or a cougar.
Mm-hmm.
They have, I think, and some people say there's still some panthers left in West Virginia in real remote places. But they talk about the way you heard a panther, and a panther would scream, and they'd say it sounded like a terrified woman screaming, and you could hear it all through the country. And then they'd tell stories about killing snakes and picking a poisonous snake up by the tail and hitting it, swinging it against a tree to kill it, and tell hunting stories, fishing stories. I made a fishing story when I was a little boy, about this same time, about 5 years old. They my uncle and two uncles and my grandfather took me fishing at Real Foot Lake in Northwest Tennessee. And we were fishing for catfish, and I got a hold of a really big fish. And of course, you know, Fanny, catfish can get really big. Oh, they can get to be over 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. You know, you there are catfish as big as a man, you know. And I got a hold of a really big fish, and it started pulling me down the bank towards the water. And it was going to pull me in the water.
But you were not letting go.
I was not letting go. And my uncle ran over to me, and he wrapped his arms around my waist. And I said, pull him in, Uncle Milburn, pull him in. Pull him in, Uncle Milburn, pull him in. And my uncle go, no, son, you got to do it. I'm going to keep you from going swimming, but you got to bring him in. And I had to crank that fish in. I don't know how long it took. It must have taken me 15, 20, maybe 30 minutes to land it. But it was a big old... Some of your listeners will know this word. It was a big old garfish, about as long as my arm. And garfish are, they are leftovers like alligators from the dinosaur age. They're big, ugly, got a mouth full of teeth and real hard scales. But that was one of the stories I created that took root in my family.
That's a wonderful story. That's a scary story. You watch your child, your nephew, slid down the bank. Did you get to eat him?
No.
Not an edible fish?
No.
Or not that good an edible
fish? Not that good. Very, very bony and very tough meat. You know, they're
I've seen pictures.
Yeah. Well, they're real.
Good story.
I know.
Are there still lots of those garfish left, do you think?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely in the slow-moving, muddy rivers.
So they're not endangered.
No, they're like not endangered.
Many others.
Yeah.
Okay. I need to do a station identification.
Oh, please
do. Hold that thought. You're listening to the Epic Radio Storytelling Hour. This is your host, Fanny Crawford, on Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And you're listening to storyteller, labor organizer, and West Tennessee boy.
Right, there you go.
Stuart Acuff, sharing stories so far from his early childhood.
Yeah.
I want to hear a bit more about your mom as a storyteller, and you've mentioned a couple times, not just today, but you've mentioned that she wanted you to know how hard she worked on that farm, and
absolutely
chopping cotton was not a fun way to spend a long hot summer.
No,
on Mississippi bottomland. So why do you think it was so important for her that you know that? Was she protecting you, or did she want credit?
She was not protecting me, I guarantee you that. She used to say, I ain't going to have no sorry children.
What a great line.
You know, I started driving a tractor, working like a man, when I was 11 years old. She was determined that none of her kids were going to be lazy. And my first job, I was 5 or 6 years old. My dad was in seminary. We lived in married students housing. Mm-hmm. And I used to take the people's trash out to the dumpster. For one customer gave me 3 cents. Another one gave me a quarter. No, I never did get as high as a dime. But my mother, she was determined that we know the value of hard work. And that we define ourselves in part by being hard workers. And the two things that get you most in trouble with my folks were talking back. That gets you whooping right quick. And with my mother, being lazy. And so, you know, I always had a job when I wasn't playing basketball. I played basketball. Yeah. Yeah. So she was a great storyteller. You know, she'd sit down at the kitchen table and she'd talk about her family's history and where her people came from and what we knew about them. And there wasn't that much to know, but she was a great storyteller, loved to do it. Now, Joe A. Cuff, I'm telling this story. You be quiet.
Were you say us, so there were other kids?
Yeah. I had a brother and a sister. Both, I was the oldest.
Oh, you were the oldest. I never knew that part.
Yeah. I was the oldest PK. That's a dangerous boy now. The oldest PK. The oldest son of the pastor of the First Baptist Church, Hellbent, Tennessee.
Oh, that just conjures up so many stories, and I haven't even heard them yet. Okay, so the other kids, so the three of you were often gathered around the table listening to your mom.
Yeah.
And were her stories in some way different from the stories that your dad told, or were her purposes, her intents different in some ways from your dad's?
You know, she had the richer background for stories. My dad was an only child. Okay. And he was born to really dirt poor poverty in the Boot Hill of Missouri, southeast Missouri, right in a little town called Crothersville, right on the Mississippi River. I mean, the downtown butted up against the levees of the Mississippi River. And when he was a young man, right after he went off to college to become a minister, his parents joined the Great Migration North, and they went to St. Louis for union jobs. And you know, as the people were leaving the South, black and white people were leaving the South, and Indian people too. Generally, they were going north for industrial jobs, and which were union or becoming union. Mm-hmm. And that would have been in the 50s. And he and my grandmother, he was Papaw and she was Mamaw. And
of course.
Right. And they went to St. Louis, Missouri. He went to work at American Can Corporation, which was organized by the steelworkers. And she went to work at the big flagship Woolworths on Grand Avenue downtown St. Louis, and a member of the Retail Clerks Union. And that is how they dragged themselves from, you know, really dirt poor poverty. He was American Indian. Mm-hmm. And dirt poor poverty into the American middle class.
So going off to college to become a minister,
right?
Was that one of the few things that you could go to college for, if that was your background?
Well, in my dad's time, mm-hmm. yeah, that you know, they were the he didn't have anybody in his family who'd ever been to college, and
sure.
neither did my mother. And so that was a real blessing for me, because they taught me the love of books and the expectation of being facile with the written word.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you often come across when you're reading African American history mm-hmm. is that the ministry was the only white collar occupation or vocation open to African Americans.
Right. Unless you
reading
could
and writing was frowned upon and not supported, unless
right.
you were gonna, and even then, and it was, of course, an oral tradition, mm-hmm. More than a print tradition.
Right. Right.
But you did learn to read the Bible, so
right, right.
Yeah.
And it was very much an oral tradition for my father. Mm-hmm. Like I say, he was a great old line Baptist preacher. And my favorite image of my father from my childhood is in this one little town called Obion, Tennessee, First Baptist Church, Obion, Tennessee. middle of the summer, probably July, windows all up, hotter than blue blazes. He's preaching. He's got his jacket off, his suit coat off. He's got his tie pulled down, his neck, his collar unbuttoned, his Bible in his one hand and his handkerchief in the other, wiping his brow and preaching his
iconic
soul out, you know.
Yeah.
My dad used to say, you know, at the altar call, when it'd be time for people who didn't know Jesus to get saved, my dad would say, "Would to God I could make that decision for you. Would to God I could decide this for me. You are not promised another week on this earth. Don't count on being able to come back here and save your eternal soul next week. You may only have today." Yeah.
Wow. Well, now I can see where Stuart Acuff comes from. Can you do a station break for us?
Or sure.
A station identification? You may know exactly what you want to say.
There's friends and neighbors, this is Fanny Crawford's Storytelling Hour at noon on Mondays. And she's a great storyteller and a great radio hostess, whatever you want to say. And I'm awful pleased to be with her today. This is Epic Radio, www.enlightenradio.org, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, Epic, also known as the Rock of Appalachia. The Rock of Appalachia.
Whoa. Fire and brimstone right here.
Right.
Above the Four Seasons bookstore.
Yep.
I want to do a little bit of calendar information for our listeners, and then we'll go back to story, if that's
great.
Okay with you,
sure.
Stuart. Okay, well, this is Shepherdstown, so I always talk about the Speak Story series that Shepherdstown's favorite son, Adam Booth, organizes. Now, we're on break from the Speak series. He won't start up again until April, but I did want you to know what's coming up. We have Antonia Rocha, a Brazilian-American storyteller and mime. I've heard him both on DVD or CDs and live on the stage, and you have to see this man on stage to really appreciate the power of his presence when he's telling stories. He will be at Speak for the opening session, which is April 18th. And if you go to the Speak website at www.speakwv.org, you can also see who else is coming up after that. I'm not sure that Adam has the full schedule up, but I know that he's working on those contracts. He won't tell you exactly who's coming until he has contracts from them. But
wise man.
Yeah. But I do know about Antonia Rocha. So that would be 7:30 p.m. at the Shepherdstown Community Building, or the Men's Club, you may know it, by the War Memorial Building, second floor, 7:30 p.m., April 18th. That's a Tuesday. Usually Speak is on the second Tuesday, but in order to get Antonia Rocha, Adam has moved that one session to be the third Tuesday in April. After that, he goes back to the second Tuesday format. You can also call Adam at 304-886-9481. And in Hagerstown, we have the Stories in the Round series, also on break for the winter, but we will be starting up again on April 24th, which is the fourth Monday. Stories in the Round meets fourth Monday in general. And we meet at 7 at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown on Searfoss Pike, 13245 Searfoss Pike, that's Salem Avenue extended, if you know Hagerstown. And our first storyteller of the year will be Eloise Schottler, who's coming back after 3 years. She hasn't been with us for three seasons, so we're very happy that she's going to open for us this year. And she's going to do an hour-long program, a single extended story called Ready to Serve, which is about American nurses from Johns Hopkins University who were sent to the front in France in World War I and saved thousands of lives while they were over there. They were very brave women. This was the first time that American women had been sent overseas as nurses by the U.S. government. That was the start, the inspiration, and the insurance almost that American women would join the military because they did such a fine job of saving lives and became indispensable. They were also a bit naive, never having been exposed to the military or to war in quite this way before. They were fairly young. I think the oldest was in her middle 30s. And some of them were as young as 18 and 19 years old, students at Johns Hopkins University Hospital. So come out on April 24th, the fourth Monday of the month, to hear Eloise Schottler tell that story.
Sounds great.
It is an amazing story. Lots of angst and danger and humor as well.
And awful tragedy, I'm sure.
Yeah, suffering in war in a way that we often don't hear about. Mm-hmm. But because we are on hiatus from our regular Stories in the Round series, we do have a special event that just occurred that I wanted just to let you know that Eileen Evans and Charles Pace portrayed W.E.B. Du Bois, and Eileen Evans was stepping in as
Bessie
Coleman, African-American aviator who was flying before Amelia Earhart and was trained in France. So
African-American woman.
Wow. So if you hear from anybody who was at that session, I'm sure they will tell you what a wonderful experience that was. We'll be hearing from Eileen and Charles Pace more in the future. They're part of Voices from the Earth, acting troupe and storytellers who come out on a regular basis to portray African-American history and other important things that we should know about.
Right.
As we move
into the
future.
Of the things that is so compelling to me about this area, and I've been coming up here and seeing my good friend John Case and being on his morning radio show for, I guess, about 5 years now. It started when I was trying to sell books, after my first book came out, and then after my second book came out, and I was doing, as John once said, a seemingly endless book tour at the time. Because books don't sell much anymore, and generally, unless you're John Grisham, you pretty much have to sell them retail, one person at a time. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's most compelling about this area is the history with W.E.B. Du Bois, and of course the history with John Brown. And W.E.B. Du Bois, first African American to go to Harvard, I think, and matriculate from Harvard and graduate from Harvard. Brilliant, brilliant sociologist, one of our greatest sociologists. He wrote an excellent biography of John Brown. So while white people were busy talking about how crazy John Brown was, W.E.B. Du Bois was talking about how righteous he was. And of course, if you believe, as most of us do believe nowadays, that slavery was as horrible a thing to do to anybody as could be done by another human being, then acting like a zealot was the only reasonable response to it. And of course, that's what John Brown and his family, and certainly his boys, were about, was acting like agents of God, you know, trying to do what they could, put their bucket down where they were, and do what they could to end slavery in America. I don't know how I got off on that. Well, you just said W.B.
that
Du Bois.
That was not off. That was right on target. Appropriate and measured response considering what was going on.
Yeah.
I forgot there for a minute. You thank you for telling that little tale because you gave me time to collect my thoughts and remember why I wanted to tell our listeners about W.E.B. Du Bois, Charles Pace, and Bessie Coleman portraying Eileen Evans portraying Bessie Coleman, because they are coming back. They're going to be doing this session several times. So on February 8th, Eileen Evans will be at Eastern West Virginia Community and Technical College, which is not too far away, at 12:15 in the afternoon. And on February 12th, I hope to get to Harper's Ferry to Storer College to hear Eileen portray Coralie Franklin Cook, who was a mainstay and a pillar of the African-American college, Storer College.
Wow. There.
So if people want more information, they can call Eileen at 304-288-6254. Or go to www.vfte.org, that's Voices from the Earth, .org, and learn more about ticket prices and all of that. And actually, on March 22nd, there's a whole separate program of Karen Varanche, who some of our listeners may know as a West Virginia teller. She's in the West Virginia Storytelling Guild. Mm-hmm. Really a funny lady, but also can be very serious and do historical stuff. And she'll be portraying Pearl S. Buck.
Oh, yes.
And Eileen will be engaging her in conversation as Eslanda Robeson. So that's another exciting event that I may get to that. That's also at Eastern West Virginia Community. And I'm not sure I will get that far from Hagerstown, but I do hope to be at the Storer College experience. So,
yeah,
back to your stories, though.
Yeah.
I wanted our listeners to get some, I'm just curious myself. Let me mm-hmm. be perfectly honest about that. I want to know some of the stories that you heard as a kid that led to the Stuart Acuff that we all know and love today. What were those work-related stories? Those.
Well, thank you, Fanny. As I said, my dad was, the small town pastor. And Old Byne had about maybe 1,500 people in it. And it sat right on Highway 51. So when I was a kid coming up, and Malden, which was where we lived in the Boot Hill, sat right on Highway 62. Both of these were federal highways.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid coming up, people would take those highways north, and they would often stop at our house because their kids would be hungry or they'd be about to run out of gas, and they'd tell these really sad stories of being thrown off the land or whatever it was. And, preacher, the Lord just led me right to your house. I don't know how I would have found you except the Lord just led me. Well, yeah, except he stopped at the drugstore and the druggist told him where the Baptist preacher lived. But, those.
God works in meaningful ways.
Right. I grew up a little, very close to poverty. I remember one day when I was in seventh grade, we noticed a really bad odor in the classroom. And turned out that one of my classmates had been up all night catching chickens to be slaughtered. And, large birds, when they're afraid, they just, lots of stuff comes out of them.
Yeah.
And
it happens to people too.
Yes,
when you're really
absolutely And he'd been slipping and sliding in chicken manure all night, and it was all over him. And, you know, you see people that are that embarrassed or ashamed, and living that sad a life, working all night as a, what, 12-year-old boy?
And came to school the next day.
Going to school all day the next day. And you see these folks who pass through. And then I often tease my dad about this when I got grown. And I often tease John about this because John's a Quaker. And I say, you know, like to Quakers, Baptists believe the same thing. You know, you got that avenue right to Jesus. You ain't got to pray through anybody or anything. It's right there. It's a personal relationship. And so we were encouraged to pray nightly and to read the Bible. Well, it turns out that a big chunk of the Bible is pretty revolutionary literature.
You've noticed that.
Absolutely. And, you know, Matthew 25, when Jesus says, when I was sick, did you care for me? When I was hungry, did you give me to eat? When I was thirsty, did you give me water? When I was naked, did you clothe me? And the disciples said, well, Lord, when were you ever any one of these things? And Jesus said, whatsoever ye have done unto the least of these, ye have done also unto me. Jesus, I don't mean to go into a religious service here, but Jesus took the part of the poorest amongst us. That's who Jesus wanted to be identified with. The woman at the well, the Samaritan at the well, the Samaritan on the road, who was robbed on the road. The Jewish man who was robbed on the road, but who was taken to an inn by a Samaritan, right? And then I had this really wonderful thing happen to me when I was grown. Another one of my favorite passages of Scripture is in the Old Testament, Jeremiah. There's a reason Jeremiah Wright is named Jeremiah. Jeremiah was known as the angry prophet. And in Jeremiah 22:3, Jeremiah wrote, render justice every morning and deliver those who are oppressed from the power of their oppressor, and do no harm to the widow nor the alien. The alien being undocumented people from another land. And I was sitting in my office when I was president of the Atlanta AFL-CIO, and one of my heroes came in to see me. He's a great farm worker organizer named Baldemar Velasquez. He's also a Pentecost preacher. He's a great organizer and a Pentecost preacher. Really a wonderful man, a holy man. And we had this great conversation. And for some reason, I mentioned that passage. And Baldemar said, you know, Stuart, that's my favorite passage in the Bible. I said, well, why is that, Baldemar? He says, because it says, and do no harm to the alien. Of course, most farm workers on the East Coast, this is a little bit different on the West Coast, but on the East Coast, most farm workers on the East Coast are migrants from Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala. Mm-hmm. They're documented mostly. Now, the union provides their documentation in Mexico before they even come up.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's really cut down on the coyotes, the... those who
exploiters,
right? I don't know, you know, you're surrounded by racism, you're surrounded by poverty, and you read revolutionary Jesus's words, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and you know, it fits, you know, it takes you to a different place, but it fits. So that's how I came to be what I came to be.
So my childhood memories are growing up with parents who were consciously trying to teach me about race and class and how the world works underneath what we're supposed to learn in school. Mm-hmm. And they did a little bit of storytelling. Mostly mm-hmm. they gave me books, occasionally took me to meetings, mm-hmm. corrected me when I went astray, any comments that I made. I remember talking to my mother when, as a 7-year-old or so, talking about Schwarzes, because that's what I heard the teachers in my elementary school called the African-American kids, who were darker skinned than me.
Right.
And they were laughing, the teachers were laughing when they said it, so I thought it was a joke. I didn't know it was the equivalent of nigger in Yiddish. And my mother stopped me right there and asked me where I heard that and what I could do about it.
Right.
But storytelling was not their primary means. It was really important to my dad as far as family history went. And he did have a lot of his own stories about organizing. But I never thought of storytelling as the primary means of education within the family. I thought it was books.
Right.
It took me, I was an adult before I figured out that storytelling was at least as important. It didn't sink in as a child. Right. I thought it was, those stories were fun. Right. So I was curious as to whether you were conscious of that process going on, and if it felt like an independent search or journey for you, or if your whole family was engaged in that process.
Well, no, the whole family was engaged in that process, and the stories continued. Like my grandmother, my father's mother, her father was a sharecropper and a tenant farmer. And when the Dust Bowl started, they lived in West Texas, near Odessa and Sweetwater, Texas. They packed up and went back to Caruthersville, Missouri. And the way they did it was they had two mules. And they got a wagon and packed it full of their stuff and took the wagon. They walked because riding was just for the furniture and stuff, mm-hmm. and took the wagon back to Fort Worth, Texas, and sold the mules and everything they had to buy train tickets back to Caruthersville, Missouri. So my grandmother, she would tell those stories up until when she, was too feeble to really recall them. And she'd complete with the names of the mules and, you know, the adventures along the way. And, you know.
So what year would that, what decade would that have been?
Well, my dad was, that would have been the teens. My dad was born in 1930, so that would have been the teens.
No,
you know, the very start, the earliest start of the Dust Bowls, and that's where I don't know if you've ever heard the old Southern expression "tall cotton." That's where that expression came from, because in Texas they grew short cotton, and it was really painful to work because you had to bend over all day,
mm-hmm.
and. In the Southeast, they grew tall cotton, and it was painful as well, but at least you didn't have to bend over all day, or at least not that far over.
I think I always assumed that had something to do with the fibers, the length of the fibers, but it's the length, it's the length, height of the plant.
The yeah. stalk, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the height of the stalk.
Hmm. Whoa. Well, we could keep going and going and going.
Oh, yeah, you have no idea how much I have.
Well, let me just tell our listeners what's going on here. This is Epic Radio, the Epic Storytelling Hour on Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, enlightenradio.org. And we're talking, this is Fanny Crawford, your storytelling host, and we're talking with Stuart Acuff, labor organizer, storyteller, and just a wise man who has been gathering these
stories. An old man.
Well, it's often the same thing. I want you to share a poem.
Oh, good.
At least one with us. And then I have another request for a story.
Oh, okay. I don't know how you want to do this. I'll do one now and maybe another one later on if we have time and if you want me to. I write a lot of poetry. I don't think I'm probably that good, but I have been published several dozen times, and there might be a book in the works.
All right. Well, yeah. I like what I've seen so far.
Thank you. Thank you. The journal that has published most of my poems that have been published is called the Blue Collar Review, and it's a great little working class literary magazine or journal. But they also have a book publishing end of it, and they've talked to me about doing a collection of my poetry, which I hope really happens. So I'm going to do this poem right now, if I can see it. I'm about half blind. This is called Justice in History, and this was published by Portside, which is a blog, well-known blog in the blogosphere. Justice has always been a struggle in our country. Just yesterday, we celebrated Rosa Parks' bus ride and the Battle of Seattle anniversary. The strong or want to be strong do not hide. We who pray for strength in the lonesome night, who know what our call is, but seek an out. Did Jesus not ask that the cup be passed in Gethsemane? We know the result of actions is a fight. For that which defines what we are about, fear is not weakness. Fear is not weakness. But our humanity overcoming that fear is the power of the inspired soul and our place amongst the greats of our history. W.B. Du Bois, for example.
I really like that one.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Means a lot.
Do you want to tell another now, or do you want to do a story first?
Let me do a story.
Okay, sure. Well, the two stories that I'm most intrigued by, and it's your choice, obviously. I grew up in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and was close to a family whose patriarch was involved with 1199, mm-hmm. who was a hospital and healthcare worker and was part right. of that long struggle in Philadelphia. So I'm interested in that story. And then, of course, there's the exciting tale of the Atlanta Olympics. And
well, I'll tell the Atlanta Olympics first. And if we have time, I can talk a little bit about 1199. Great union. Let me just say this about 1199. Before that union was born, birthed by mainly the women hospital workers, the average wage in Philadelphia hospitals was less than a dollar an hour. And now you can walk into a hospital and get an unskilled job as a housekeeper or a cleaning tech or in the kitchen for $24 an hour. That union literally created the backbone of the black middle class in Philadelphia, has had all kinds of everything to do with the development of that city over the last 30, 40 years.
And I would like you to add to that, that the reason that has happened is because of the necessity, the pivotal importance of those jobs. If you want to save people's lives, you have to have clean hospitals. You have to have food that's prepared well and to high standards. And that was not always the case.
No, and it wasn't, but it's really hard to keep people from getting infected in a hospital if it's not clean. and that's kind of job number one, as they say in the Hippocratic Oath, first, do no harm. And so those people who did what some folks might call menial labor, it's not menial, it's meaningful labor. But on the Atlanta Olympics, so I was elected president of the Atlanta AFL-CIO in 1990, in part because the 1996 Olympics were coming to Atlanta. And we did not expect the work to be done union. And of course, Atlanta's in Georgia, deep south. And so the initial discussions had the head of the Olympics committee saying, this is going to be the first Olympics in the history of the world done completely with finances from the private sector, not from the public sector. And so the work is going to be done at the lowest rate possible. I'm going to save the gist of this story for another story hour, because it is my favorite story. In the course of the fight, we got behind a young African American city council member, and who had the support of Maynard Jackson. His name was Bill Campbell, to be elected mayor. And we got him elected mayor. And the election night, when he went to make his victory speech, he said, Stuart, I want you right here with our family. And so I walked up on the stage with him and his two kids and his beautiful wife. And the mayor, after he thanked his family, he said, I want to thank Stuart Acuff and all of organized labor, because I wouldn't be mayor if it wasn't for organized labor. And I know one thing for sure tonight. Ain't no labor like organized labor.
Oh, why, that's your favorite story.
Ain't no labor like organized labor. It was a great, great, great night, and it led to a lot of great things. And one of the things that mayor did was, for the first time since 1968, collective bargaining was illegal for public employees in Georgia, like it is for most public employees in the South. Mm-hmm. He did something that hadn't been done since 1968. He signed the first memorandum of understanding with a union representing city workers since Mayor Loeb had done that in Memphis right after Dr. King was assassinated. Nobody had to get assassinated for Bill Campbell. I've got one real quick story I've got to tell this, talking about Bill Campbell. John Sweeney, who was a president of AFL-CIO, he came to speak at one of our Dr. King breakfasts. And the governor, who we had supported, was trying to privatize state workers. And the mayor had signed this memorandum of understanding, which, amongst other things, outlawed any privatization of any work. And John Sweeney stood up there in front of 2,000 people and people from all over the world. And he said, you know, we're in this fight with the governor and we supported him. We supported him, did everything we could to get him elected. And now he's trying to privatize our work. Meanwhile, in Atlanta, we have an African-American mayor who's making sure that none of our works get privatized. And John Sweeney, he'd asked me permission to do this the night before. He said, I guess that's the difference between a brother and a peckerwood. Now, your listeners are not going to know that a peckerwood in the South is a souped-up redneck. It's like the worst kind of redneck you ever saw. John Sweeney said, I guess that's the difference between a brother and a peckerwood.
Words for the ages.
Words for the ages. Exactly. It's good to know what side you're on, and it's good to know who's on your side.
Oh, what a great hour of storytelling.
Thank you, Fanny.
This morning. Thank you, John.
I'm Stuart. John's over there. I'm the good-looking one, Fanny. Fanny, I'm the good-looking one. John's making noise. He's a radio man. He knows he's not supposed to make noise when he's off the mic. It's hot in here, John.
I apologize to both of you. I have a major feud going on now. Okay, we are out of time, but Stuart, I do want to give you a minute before I do 30 seconds of calendar reminders for our listeners. Words of wisdom, final. You just gave us three wonderful, wonderful quotes. I don't know that you can top any of those, but you could just leave it.
That. Well, you know, I got lots of great quotes on Saturday at the march. And let me just say, I'm happy today. 4 million people stood up against this abomination that we elected as president of this country. 4 million people, largest demonstration in the history of the U.S. on Saturday. I think our resistance is off very strong, is off and running very strong. And thank God it's being led by women. We need a lot more estrogen in public life and a lot less testosterone. If anybody can keep us out of war, it'll be the women.
Thank you, John.
Stuart.
Still, twice in a row. I must be programmed. I walk in this office and I have a hard time.
Right.
If it's male, it must be a John.
Right, right. Exactly.
Okay. Thanks for joining us today, yeah. Stuart.
Happy to do it, Fanny. Happy to do it.
This is your epic radio storytelling host, Fanny Crawford, signing off on Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio and the Story Hour. Keep those dates in mind. April 18th for the startup again of the Speak series that Adam Booth runs, and we have Antonio Rocha coming then. On April 18th, stay tuned for Stories in the Round starting up again on April 24th. Eloise Schottler then, and stay tuned next week to storytelling on Monday at 12 noon, because Epic Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand our own stories. Thanks for listening.